Welcome back to Bird on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Chris Cameron, and our guest this week, historian Dan Buchanan. So Dan, your new book is scheduled to be released in August 2020. Will the launch be very different this year because of COVID, do you think?
Well, it will be very different, like everything we're doing. Yes, I had at least 2,000 events already planned by March for the release in the middle of the summer, and that all got changed over to be virtual, and we are creating virtual events, and I will be basically sitting in my living room for almost all of them. I think the only in-person thing I'll be doing that I know about for sure is the Codrington Farmers Market. Once a month this summer, I'll be there.
Tell us about the Brighton History Weekend that you founded some years ago now.
Last February, we had our 8th annual event. Who knows what happens this coming year? The focus of this event is the open house, which is usually held at the end of the weekend on a Saturday now. Yes, it's always at the community center in Brighton. People in the area who are displaying history, the various museums, several of us historians, and some folks who do heritage-related demonstrations and things.
And how many people turn up and say they want to be added to your trees? Explain the concept of genealogy. How did you get into it?
Well, I've always been a history buff, and I spent most of my life reading history. And I, late in the 90s, I got kind of tired of that and thought I wanted to do something more direct. And I started to look at my own family tree and saw what the software was like and that there were internet tools available. And once I got involved in that, it was like a drug. It was like an obsession. I couldn't get away from it. And it just grew and grew and grew. After a few years, when I looked at my database, I started to see it as just another way to see local history. And so that just grew. And of course, I was in the wave of interest for that. That was all around the world. I became a regular on Ancestry. In 2004, I put my own database up. When people can see the data, they sometimes email me about corrections, sometimes additions. I get whole branches of a family of somebody that was here in the 1840s and moved to Michigan. I get a whole branch of that family from somebody who's seen it and wants to add to it. Even now when I do my books, when I choose a story to do in a book, the first research I do is to choose, find all the people and do the family trees for those people. It's like therapy to me. I can spend all day doing the history work, which is like sometimes brain numbing, especially if you're in editing and things like that. But then I can sit down and do 2-3 hours of genealogy and I'm good to go.
Well, it can certainly take up a great deal of time, I know, from the little that I do. So please read some more to us from the wreck of HMS Speedy.
This is in part 2 about the search for the Speedy. It's just as Ed Bird is getting his project underway. The license and funding applications were bore fruit in April 1990 as preparations were underway to make sure the equipment and crew were ready to take advantage of the first good weather. Unfortunately, Mother Nature was not cooperative, and so the crew's first day in the lake was not until the middle of June. They began their survey work with the objective of locating the items shown in the video, and I referred to a video that Ed took in 1989 that showed him articles on the bottom of the lake that he thought might be from an old ship. Between June and October that year, Bert and his crew spent 19 days out on the lake. Terry Coons, Bert's childhood friend and a professional diver who acquired his training with the U.S. Navy, was the chief diver for the project as well as a director with the HMS Speedy Foundation. Coons was responsible for managing the dives and the divers, and he did the bulk of the diving himself. A remotely operated video camera would record images onto tape, and when items were of interest were identified, the divers went down to find the item and take close-up underwater photographs. Of course, while this was going on, safety was top of mind for everyone. Diving in the rough and cloudy waters of Lake Ontario could be dangerous, but these experienced divers had the right equipment and lots of experience, which sometimes meant that you abort the dive in the face of high waves and gusting wind. Everything was based on the weather. For the divers, it was grueling work. Periods of good weather, when there were successive days of diving, fatigue could be a problem that needed to be managed. The best weather in 1990 was later in July and through August. During this time, coons shed body weight at an alarming rate due to the intense constant diving. Some days he was called upon a dozen or more times to go down and check out interesting shapes that had been captured on video. It was exciting to dive on a potentially historic wreck, but there was also tedious days that bore no positive results, such as the life of a professional diver. Despite the spring's high hopes, as fall approached, nothing related to the Speedy had been found. A grid layout kept the work organized, ensuring that they did not search the same area by mistake. While the results they sought were not appearing, the survey work continued. The high point for 1990 came at the very end of the season on October 14th. They had moved to another square on the grid, and in very short order, were seeing familiar shapes from the first video. There was another anchor. There was an anchor, pieces of timber, a chain, cannonballs, pulleys, and more. Finally, they had located the debris field, a term Ed Burt would use from this point forward. They were able to go out again on October 20th, and they saw more of the same things in the same general area. This was the last diving for 1990, and Ed Burt was very relieved to have something to show for a summer of intense work. He was even more excited about what they might find next year. Ken Cassavoy had been the supervising marine archaeologist for the project during the 1990 season. He completed his responsibilities by writing a report outlining the genesis of the project and the activity that took place that season. He also submitted an article for the Ontario Archaeological Report in 1991, which said that the results of the 1990 season had been inconclusive. He added, however, that promising sightings had occurred late in the season, and given the historical importance of the Speedy, work should continue. Cassavoy did not return to the project in 1991 because of the many demands on his time and his belief that he had not seen enough evidence to support the theory that Burt and his crew had found the remains of HMS Speedy. He indicated he would be happy to return to more if more definitive evidence was found. But in the meantime, there were other projects to work on. This would have significant consequences. It would cause a change in the terms of the archaeological licenses issued by the ministry for the Speedy project. The rules for handling underwater artifacts took into consideration the experience and expertise of the licensee. With a professional marine archaeologist as the licensee in 1990, the license said they were allowed to retrieve limited number of artifacts for the purpose of identifying the ship. Unfortunately, the debris field was not located until the end of the season. So retrieving artifacts to identify the ship was not yet possible, even if the license allowed for it. The license for 1991 was taken out by Ed Burt, who was not a certified archaeologist. As a result, the underwater survey clause in the license read, "Retrieval of artifacts from underwater sites is not covered under this license." The practical impact of this was to prevent Ed and his crew from retrieving any artifacts, even if they found items that would be useful in identifying the ship. These restrictions were designed to protect underwater artifacts from destruction by careless divers and treasure hunters. In this case, however, they had the effect of putting the Speedy project in an impossible situation. If the identity of the ship was not yet confirmed, the professional archaeologist would not be inclined to pursue the project. On the other hand, if artifacts could not be retrieved, then the ship would not likely be identified. It was a classic catch-22.
I see that it's really, really complicated. How does a person who isn't qualified get licensed?
Well, it's very complicated, as you say. They will offer licenses to anyone who can mount a project. But the rules of that license control what they can do.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, for coming in and talking about your new book and some of your other projects. Where will our listeners be able to buy the wreck of the HMS Speedy, the tragedy that shook Upper Canada?
In all bookstores. I am glad to say that the Indigo People, the largest bookseller in Canada, love this book. It will be distributed across the country with lots of promotion in store and online. Plus, of course, your local bookstores. I encourage people to support your local bookstores. It will be widely available and in the news in August, around when the time comes out. So I'm grateful for that. I don't know what that means exactly, but hopefully a lot of people will see this story.
And it'll be available online too, you said, right?
All the various sites, ebook version. I'm actually even in the process of producing a video with the story as well.
Well, to connect with us, listeners, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for who we might interview in future programs to our website, wordonthehills.com, where all our broadcasts are archived. We love to hear from you and welcome your comments on our programs. Thanks for tuning in to the show. We hope you'll join us for another program next week on Northumberland 89.7, Truly Local Radio.